Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its landmark Brown v. Board of Education decision, ending racial segregation in the nation's public schools. 3 years later, in 1957, Dorothy Count Scoggins was among the first black children to enter what were previously whites-only Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. She enrolled at Harding High, and on the first walk into the building, faced threats and taunts as she was escorted in. The harassment and hostility from some of her white classmates would continue. It wasn't easy, but it was a start. In fact, CMS at one point became a national example of how integration could work and work well. Now, things are reverting back, with schools slowly resegregating, and it's coming at a time when some have forgotten our history and others are trying to gloss it over, change it, ignore it. Today, we look back on that historic moment and ahead to how the lessons learned then could and should serve us now and at our history and how it should be taught. Dorothy Count Scoggins is with us for the hour, along with Dr. Dan Aldridge, Professor of History and Africana Studies at Davidson College, and Dr. James Ford is back with us. He's a former teacher at Garinger High, also North Carolina Teacher of the Year, and is now Executive Director of CREED NC. That's the Center for Racial Equity in Education. Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Dorothy, I'm going to start with you because I would be derelict if I did not. You've been on this program several times in the past. We've talked about your pioneering role in integrating public schools here in the city in 1957, but many might not know your story because we have short-term memories in this country. If old photographs and old news film clips are any indication, what sticks out to me is the hatred and the vitriol being flung at a 15-year-old girl, you, as she peacefully walks toward the entrance at Harding High. When you think back on that moment in your life, what feelings does it evoke? What memories does it bring up?
Well, Mike, one of the things I say to people that when I think back, you know, it is I am who I am today because of that experience. That's one of the things that I always said I learned from that. And I said that whatever happened to me, that which happened to me at Harding would not happen to another child. So basically, when I say that, it's because of the work that I have chosen to do over the last 68 years. And I have talked, a lot of people have asked me, you know, how can you forgive them? And I said, I forgave them because they were teenagers the same as I. But you have to remember, the hatred and the bigotry was taught by the adults.
And you actually reconciled with one of the hecklers who threw insults and harassment at you. You actually made up with him later in life. What prepared you for that experience? That must have been terribly frightening. Anybody 15 years old, walking down a sidewalk, escorted by police, being jeered at, taunted, things, epithets being thrown at you. At 15, what prepared you for that?
My parents, especially my father. Of course, you know, my father was a professor, Johnson C. Smith, but also a minister. And I remember that morning as we sat at the breakfast table preparing for me to go to Harding after we had prayer that morning. And he said to me, are you going to be okay? And I said, yes, Dad, I'm going to be okay. But when we got to Harding and I saw the crowd of people and the street was blocked, but my father could not drive me to the entrance of the school, he said to me, remember, you can do anything that you want to do. You are not inferior to anyone, and stand up and be proud of who you are. So as I got out of the car, those are the words that I carried with me for that two blocks to the auditorium. But I also said I kept my eyes on the door because I said, once I get inside of the auditorium, everything was going to be okay.
Was it?
No.
Yes, because you didn't last.
The same kinds of things that were happening outside happened inside. And I guess surprising to me, there were teachers lined up alongside the wall. The principal was standing in front of all of us on the stage. He saw the things that were going on and he ignored it. And for me, I've always been taught respect, especially for educators, because I have a line of educators in my family. And I could not believe that they were standing there watching the kinds of things that were done to me inside the auditorium.
Charlotte likes to think that it took a very successful and calm approach to the societal changes that were going on as a result of the civil rights movement. We've heard stories of how business people in Charlotte voluntarily integrated restaurants as kind of a peremptory strike against any trouble that might result if anybody tried to protest that. We did not want the kind of stain on our city that other southern cities had because of how they fought the civil rights movement. We did have marches here demanding equality, and well after our schools were integrated in 1965, civil rights attorney Julius Chambers and several other prominent civil rights leaders like Reginald Hawkins and Fred and Kelly Alexander all had their homes or offices bombed for their efforts toward racial equality. And of course, your entry into the public schools was accompanied by that angry throng of people, children and adults acting equally badly toward you. That was a long time ago. And yet we are still experiencing some of the same challenges. And I'm curious, Dorothy, how your experience living through that moment influenced your life and how you've lived it, and what it could teach others about the moment we're living in today.
After I graduated from college, I worked in a center for abused and neglected children in New York. And there again, I saw the kinds of things that were happening to children. And I accepted a job teaching in a preschool program in New York. And that's when I found out that was my niche, that you start at a very young age. Because if you start teaching at a young age, then hopefully the things that happened to me would not happen to them. So I chose early childhood as my career. And I was in that field for over 40 years. Not only did I work with children, but I also worked with administrators and teachers, teaching them this tolerance, acceptance, because I was not accepted. And I wanted to make sure that they understood the importance of that. I came back to Charlotte in December, and I came back to Charlotte in the late 60s, and this was after Charlotte, in terms of integration of Charlotte Network Schools. And so I did some other kinds of things, but I guess early childhood career just kept pulling me back. And so that's what I did. And when I retired in 2012, I said, I'm not going to go home and put a blanket over my knees and sit in a rocking chair. Now is the time for me to continue the work. So then I started working, doing some volunteer work in Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools because I saw what was beginning to happen. I told people then that these kinds of things that are happening today were going to happen. So that's the work that I've been doing at my age.
Why did you know that? Why did you think? And when you say the kinds of things that are happening today, what are you referring to? And why did you?
Our schools being resegregated, number one, because I was around when of course, when they had school choice, and I knew where that was going, and going to school board meetings and listening to the conversations that were being had. And I said, 10 years from now, Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools is not going to look like what it looked like then.
All of that, we're going to talk about that in some depth as we go through the hour. Dr. Dan Aldridge is with us. He's a professor of history and Africana studies at Davidson College. And this landmark Supreme Court decision, Brown v. Board of Education, as I said, was handed down in 1954. 3 years later, Dorothy Count Scoggins walked through the doors of Harding High School. But in other areas of the country, I went to T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, Virginia. It was built to integrate the city of Alexandria school systems, and it opened its doors in 1965. That was 11 years after the Supreme Court decision. So explain to me, Dr. Harding, why it took, Dr. Aldridge, why it took so long.
Well, when the Supreme Court declared school segregation unconstitutional in 1954, what the Supreme Court didn't have was a way of enforcing that among the thousands and thousands of school districts all throughout the United States. The court, in its a decision a couple of years after Brown won, had to decide, well, how should we enforce that? And there were some justices, Hugo Black, the one who was a white Southerner, said you have to do it now. That has to be sort of like shock and awe, immediate implication that if you don't, that resistance will build up. I think the quote he said, the guys who yell nigger will be in charge of Southern politics. The court balked at requiring immediate compliance, said, okay, all deliberate speed, which is means all fast, slow, that they well, gradually, if integration happened gradually, they hope it'll happen peacefully and without incident. But of course, gradual integration to white places like in North Carolina, a moderate segregationist place, which was less bad than Birmingham. What they did here was just very slow token compliance. So they dragged, foot dragged, and resisted for years because they weren't required to do anything but sort of slowly make progress towards racial integration. In fact, it was so glacially slow, it was almost never going to happen. So that's what happened here.
Democrats in North Carolina controlled the levers of power back then. It wasn't until the last decade or so that Republicans have taken over after 100 years. And 4 days after the 1954 court ruling, the keynote speaker at a gathering of the state's ruling Democrats said, quote, "As good citizens, we have no other course except to obey the law laid down by the United States Supreme Court." But then the General Assembly turned around and created the Pearsall Plan, which gave local school boards full control of the desegregation process. What was the intent of that, Dr. Aldridge?
Well, the intent was to, basically say we're complying with desegregation without actually having integration. Was, I think, what they're trying to do. They're trying to say we're complying. It's we're obeying Brown, but yet there is no that much integration on the ground. So it's a way of, again, I guess, anticipating what you're seeing in the present. We're not segregated, but there's a high correlation between, race and the school you attend, even though it's not segregation. I think that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, Dan Aldridge teaches history and Africana studies at Davidson College. He's here along with Dorothy Count Scoggins, a civil rights pioneer in Charlotte and somebody who continued on through all of her professional life to be that pioneer. And Dr. James Ford is also with us. We haven't heard from him yet, and I don't have time to ask you a question in the time remaining in this segment, James, but I'll start with you when we come back. He was North Carolina Teacher of the Year. He now runs CREED, the Center for Racial Equity in Education. And we're talking about where we are today, where we've come from, what we've learned, what we haven't learned, and what lessons from history, what the lack of learning those lessons is causing us to repeat, unfortunately, in many cases. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a little piece of Charlotte history, which is also a big part of American history, and that is the civil rights movement. and how the schools were integrated and what has come of that with a civil rights pioneer, Dorothy Counts Scoggins, who integrated Harding High School in 1957. Dr. Dan Aldridge teaches history at Davidson College. Dr. James Ford was a history teacher. He's now executive director of CREED and C, the Center for Racial Equity in Education. As students probably told you, James, why do I have to learn this? It's old. It's history. It's not going to affect my life. But in fact, it is going to affect your life. And we're seeing this happening right now because we have forgotten big chunks of our history, and not just civil rights, a whole panoply of things that we have forgotten. And that's why we are in the pickle that we're in right now. As a former history teacher, how is that period of history taught, the civil rights era?
Yeah, so first of all, I want to say that, you know, the premise that I have always used in teaching history was exactly what you just said, that history is the greatest predictor of the future. And that's the functional utility of it. And I wish that more of us would use it in that way. In terms of civil rights, it's highly contested, right? Teachers have a lot of flexibility in how they populate that curriculum. So you could spend a whole lot of time on it, or you could kind of skim over it. I can tell you when I was growing up, they kind of talked about Dr. King, Malcolm X, and kind of moved on to the next thing, right? Brown versus Board of Education. But, you know, it all really does depend on the teacher. And I think that's something that most people don't know, even as there's all this battle and debate about what's taught in the classroom, is that teachers have a lot of authority to edit, to expand on, and supplement information about the civil rights movement. I wish it would be more mandated and more honest and accurate in its portrayals.
We don't like to talk about it much. We don't like to dwell on it because that's the past. We're beyond that, but we're not beyond that. Our America is defined by its intersection and its history with race. And it dates back to slavery. It follows us through Jim Crow and the inequalities that held people back, like redlining, that prevented families from building wealth and pulling themselves out of poverty. Racial attitudes, blatant or unrecognized, it seems to me, have resulted in all sorts of inequities that plague us all, not just black people, white people, Asian people, indigenous people. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, that's woke ideology, Mike, that you just spouted right there. That's social justice warrior stuff. But I say that in jest to say that these are facts. These are uncontestable facts. But the issue is, and this is why I think that there's so much angst around incorporating these various histories, is that when you decide to talk about the history of this nation, perhaps from my perspective, from African-American perspective, it cuts through the heart of a lot of our dominant narratives that we like to spout, the mythologies that we created about this nation. And, you know, that's inherently political. And it's uncomfortable because, you know, what do you do when you've given almost religious status to some of these ideas, some of these notions of American exceptionalism and this being the city on the hill, when you have a population that has been chattel enslaved, you know, that has been, as you mentioned, redlined, that has been discriminated against for decades and not even given the right to vote, spat upon as they tried to enter schools and desegregate. What is one to do with these two competing narratives? And rather than really do that hard work to improve our society out of fear, I think dominant populations have decided to attempt to whitewash and black out those stories. And however unsuccessful it'll be, I think that it's motivated by a fear of losing control of the narrative.
Dorothy, you mentioned, you used a phrase, because you've dedicated your life since integrating the schools here to educating children and beginning at a very young age in kindergarten, because that's where you shape ideals and morals, etc., in young people. Predating the 1954 Supreme Court decision, Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote a musical called South Pacific, in which they wrote a song called You Have to Be Carefully Taught. And it was about racism. And it was groundbreaking for its time, because those were the kinds of things you didn't talk about in Broadway musicals. But you spent your whole time dealing with tiny little kids and teaching them and helping them learn from you. Has that worked? From what you've witnessed, if you start early, does it imprint? Does it stick? Or are we seeing people backslide?
also I think people backslide. A lot of that has to do with James talked about is who that teacher is. And a lot of it has to do with generations. You know, I can work with young children and I can be their teacher. But if they go home, if their parents are not their teacher, then what I have taught them is not going to stick. And that comes from generations not being taught history. They have no knowledge. So how can they teach their children? A lot of it, you know, has to do with acceptance. One of the things that we always did, especially in preschool programs, is to make sure that we had things in our classrooms that represented all children. Books, other kinds of equipment, so they would know, they can look at a book, yes, that looks like me, but there's somebody else in this book that does not look like me. And so we could answer those questions when children, young children are very inquisitive. So when they would ask questions, at least we could explain to them, this looks like this is you, but this is not you. And this is why you need to accept them and their culture, because they don't look like you, but they are like
you. Dr. Aldridge, the political right pushed back on integration. They pushed back on civil rights advances. They are pushing back today on efforts based on diversity, equity, and inclusion, saying that we should be merit-based and not one that focuses on the color of your skin or your abilities or your disabilities or what country you came from or your parents came from, your minority status, in other words. And that kind of echoes what Dr. King dreamed about. A day would come when we would be judged by the content of our character and not the color of our skin. So is this pushback against DEI justified or another example of efforts to keep certain people down?
It's both. There are, you can find instances of both. Yeah. My sense of the pushback, what you just said, is quite true. I mean, one of the central goals of the civil rights movement was to be free to be Black, in the sense that, you know, otherwise qualified individuals should not be held back from any opportunity or being anything because of their identity. That's true. Yeah. But we're also affected by hundreds of years of slavery and Jim Crow. So even if every vestige of Jim Crow racism ended tomorrow, we'd have a great deal of race-linked inequality because that Black people are poor. We suffer from underdevelopment, lack of capital, generations of lack of education, lack of social capital, lack of financial capital. Those things don't evaporate just with equal opportunities. So I think opportunity is good. And we should present that. But we also have to have more attack directly on sort of the class-based aspects of inequality. We see that Black people have been, you know, held back from generations of slavery and Jim Crow. It did terrible things to us in terms of our socioeconomic position. And while I support equality in general, I have seen bad DEI programs too. And I think that's part of what people are objecting to, is ones that are like Stalinist struggle sessions about you're supposed to say this right thing versus that right thing. People being overly didactic and insistent on their particular political ideology. And my ideology is Blackness and everything else is racism. Yeah. So I think and if you look at civil rights history, the people who made civil rights movement happen were Black. They were Black Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, communists, integrationists, and nationalists. Black people are very diverse. We're not a political party. Yeah. So I think to the extent that DEI tries too much to guilt and shame people and to say my interpretation of the past is the only one that can be taught, it alienates people. My sense of history, because I teach Black history and American history, integrate them together and put different types of people in conversation with each other. So rather than us teach woke history or MAGA history, have, you know, Clarence Thomas and Angela Davis in conversation with each other. Let students learn and read about these different people and learn and judge the differences for themselves. Encourage independent thought on their part, rather than trying to use history to support one political party's view or another's.
Dr. Ford, history is written by the winners. there's a battle right now on who will win the battle for history, it seems to me. He just mentioned MAGA history, and then there's Black history. There's different takes on history. What do you see? Because there is an effort right now to control what history is being taught and right. how it is being taught. What do you see as the real intent of those efforts?
Yeah, well, so I appreciate Dr. Aldridge complicating the nuance. We don't do that very well, right? And that is to say that sometimes, you know, folks can take things to the extreme and be identity reductionist too, right? Where, you know, there's one way to see things. But I think, honestly, that's not what people are trying to achieve. They're trying to use this as a veneer of erasing people from the historical canon. You know, all the things that we complain about so-called economically developing nations as being propaganda arms, that's what this is intended to do. And it's actually quite brilliant in that it's using indoctrination as one of its words, right? It's saying that we're indoctrinating people by even introducing them to these concepts. And you know that that's the case because they don't even want them to be explored. He talked about putting these two poles in conversation with each other. They're not trying to do that. I was on the State Board of Education when we renewed our social studies standards. And I can tell you, they don't even want to discuss socialist concepts. They don't even want to know what it is they disagree with. So the idea of trying to inculcate students with the ability to achieve independent thought is not the objective. It's to wipe out folks and their perspectives that don't conform to the dominant narratives.
Well, my point was what history teacher I think you should do, not what these people are seeking. You know, I'm just saying ideally that's the goal we should seek, is putting people in conversation with each other and having. It's why I was a college teacher where we had much more freedom to do whatever we want to do than you have on K-12. That's what I'm saying. I wasn't saying that this is what they want. I'm saying that we all should want is history to do these things.
Dorothy, even though things have a ways to go yet, things are unquestionably better than they were in 1957 when you walked through the doors of Harding High. And a lot of kids, as I said, this is ancient history to them. They don't understand what you went through. They can't even conceive in many cases of what you went through, although they are aware, particularly if you're a Black student, I suppose, you're aware of inequities. What's the point then of opening old wounds, of teaching this period in our history? Since things are better now, why not just ignore it and move on?
Well, you know, I've always said they need to know. And I work with a group of high school students here in Charlotte. I have a mentoring program. And they're in three predominantly Black and brown schools in Charlotte, where Charlotte, Harding, and Philip Overy. And as I talk to these students, to me it's very important that they know their history, because I ask them questions, they have no knowledge. I had a speaker to come in and talk with them, and they were talking about Rosa Parks. Can you imagine 17 students sitting there and did not know who Rosa Parks was? So what I've always been told, we need to be the ones who are responsible for teaching our children. So I have taken that on as a challenge to the mentors that are working with me. And so we have given not only teaching them, but giving them experiences so that they will understand. And my hope is they will take that information and teach the next generation. And I have 8 students now that are graduating. And over the last year, we have brought in people to talk with them. Number one, about advocacy, but history. We took them to Charleston, to the museum, but we also took them over to Beaufort to see the first school for the slaves had. Those children, we asked them, what was the best experience you had last year? And you know what they said? The trip to Charleston. Because they wouldn't have that experience through CMS. And a lot of them would not have that experience with their parents.
Dr. Aldridge, I know you want to chime in.
Yes, I was going to reiterate. That was an excellent point by Ms. Count Scoggins. And that's basically my own experience, how I learned about Black history. Growing up in New York City in the 1970s was largely through my parents. Also, I have a fortune. My great aunt was president of the National Council of Negro Women, Dr. Dorothy Hyatt So I had some connection through that, but through books, magazines, newspapers in the house, things of that sort. And I was wondering if any of you have experiences, or how can we make things that are available now and free, like internet sources, video things, more widely available to young people so they learn these things at home and we don't have to depend on the school system just for, you know, for our knowledge of Black history, that we, you know, have ownership at home and families and communities too.
I don't mind fielding that, and I just want to reiterate saying my parents definitely, you know, believed that it was their responsibility to educate us. But I think the response is returning to some of our old traditions, Saturday schools, you know, the Carter G. Woodson model, right? Like, you know, we demand and we expect for our histories to be inclusive and be taught as a part of the curriculum within the schools. But if you don't, we have institutions outside of that will produce materials and will disseminate these materials and rely upon community entities and institutions to do it for us. The churches used to do it. In Florida, in fact, even despite this backlash against inclusive history, some of the churches are doing it now. They're teaching Black history in their churches on Saturdays. We come from that tradition. And so, you know, that's why I think the notion of wiping out Black history is laughably arrogant and stupid, because you've never been able to achieve that, nor will you ever be able to do so. We're going to find ways. We always have, even before it was legal.
You were first on this program, James, when you were Teacher of the Year. That's when we met. You were evidently a remarkable history teacher and very successful with students. A lot of parents today don't want their children exposed to this because it makes them feel bad about their ancestors. Now, we're not talking about Black people necessarily, although they may feel bad about those ancestors too because they were enslaved. But white kids who may have had somebody in the family who was an overseer or owned a plantation, and they don't want their kids to feel that. And just recently, Elon Musk told a group of right-wing political party in Germany that children should not be responsible for the sins of their fathers or the sins of their grandfathers. And there's something to be said for that. That's true. But how do you teach history in such a way that it doesn't? And here comes the break. So think about this over the break, and you can answer it afterward. How do you teach children about their history in a way that doesn't make them defensive, make them sad, make them feel less of themselves because of something that happened way off in the distance past that their family may have been involved in? We'll come back and get an answer to that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. James Ford, Executive Director of CREED, the Center for Racial Equity and Education in North Carolina, Dr. Dan Aldridge, who teaches history and Africana Studies at Davidson College, and Dorothy Counts Scoggins, a local civil rights activist and pioneer. So, James, I threw the question at you as a former high school teacher. How do you teach history to kids of all stripes and not make them feel defensive, angry, sad, hurt, lesser than as a result of learning what happened in the past?
Yeah, and the answer to that is that you can't. There's no guarantee. Human beings, if they're not sociopaths, are living, feeling, meaning-making machines. And so you're going to have all types of emotional reactions to whatever it is that's being taught, be it history, be it science, be it math, or whatever. And so, you know, I think what can be done is that we can teach young people the appropriate social, emotional, and mental health skills and how to regulate those emotions, which I think is what a lot of people lack. Again, I go back to the idea of even developing a myth of racial superiority. Actually, I don't think comes from a place of self-confidence, right? It's very maladaptive, right? It comes from I think a deep-seated feeling of inadequacy. And so when you teach young people how to learn how to regulate their emotions, how to make meaning out of things without lashing out, without having their nervous systems overwhelmed, I think our responsibility as educators becomes to teach them the truth, allow them to feel what they feel, but going out of our way to protect a particular group's emotions is inevitably going to stand in the way of truth.
people who are against the teaching of that part of our history, who would like that to go away, to be whitewashed in some way or glossed over, or spend a day on it and move on, Dr. Aldridge, they got some backing from then-presidential candidate Donald Trump, who on the campaign trail repeatedly indicated that the study of the darkest corners of American history, slavery, the Confederacy, and Jim Crow, undermined national pride. Is he wrong?
Yes. All countries have difficult histories. Like the double cosine with this wonderful things James just said about history. History is not does not exist as a sort of comfort of the zone. It's not a security blanket. It's not supposed to make you feel good, make you feel proud, make
but
you
it,
feel
able but it, but safe. It flies in the face of this thing that we like to do in America, and that is say we're number one, we're number one, we're the greatest country in the world, we wear the white hats, we're the good guys.
People should learn to be more sophisticated than that. You have to challenge these things, even though people like to believe them say it. Just because Donald Trump said something, does it mean we all have to like have a Pavlovian response and think now this is the new norm in America? Black history is going to exist no matter what Donald Trump, Elon Musk, or any other person says. Yeah.
So this Dorothy,
going to go on. We're a free society. America's a lot to be proud of. We also have some demerits. Every country's like that. Yeah.
Dorothy,
it doesn't mean that because we have demerits, that we have nothing to be proud of. It's a whole false thing.
Dorothy, as somebody who lived through this era and had your own personal experiences with this, and somebody who's dedicated their lives to trying to teach children about this and about being not seeing race as a bad thing, talk to me, Dorothy, about how you teach history in a way that is not destructive but is constructive.
Well, I'm going to go back to what James said, and the main thing is to tell the truth. You know, I over the years, I have gone into CMS schools, I have gone into private schools, and I remember an incident, Mike, that I had when I went to Charlotte Latin. And of course, when I was in Charlotte Latin, my audience were privileged white students. And some of the students said to me, well, that's just the way it is. Well, I'm not going to sit there and convince them. And I said to them, James, the same what you just said, but this is the truth. And you can walk away from this and remember what I said and take it and do whatever you want to do with it. But what I'm telling you is this is the truth. And so I'm honest. I'm open. I don't hide anything. My purpose is to tell the truth and hope that out of the groups of students that I talk to, high school students especially, that they take one thing away from it. And I feel that if I've done that, then I'm successful.
James, America has a reading problem. Students around the country struggle with reading, something that is the foundation for their entire educational experience. Americans don't do as well in math and science as students in other parts of the world, yet you don't hear very many politicians getting involved with the nitty-gritty of how we teach those subjects. We have witnessed efforts by politicians to get involved in teaching history. Sarah Griffith, a history teacher at Queen's University of Charlotte, says, who gets to be a part of history and who doesn't get to be a part of history is incredibly powerful. And Dr. Aldridge has said that when people without any expertise put a lot of opinions, try to regulate what happens in colleges and schools, it will lead to educational decline. Do you think this attempt to whitewash history, is it a way of maintaining power? Because leaders have long known that if you control the narrative, you retain the power.
Absolutely. And I'm going to paraphrase Toni Morrison here to say that, like, you know, at the end of the day, it's a shame to have to feel like you got to cut somebody down to feel tall. And that's, I think, what's happening here. It's about cultural struggle, retaining cultural dominance. And as you've noted, by doing that, by majoring in the minor, inevitably the whole of the nation is going to suffer. It turns out we're not burning it up when it comes to reading. You know, it's no small wonder then that education and our attainment overall for students in the United States is not on par, not where it should be, right, in the American psyche, in terms of our performance, because we're focusing on things that are really trivial, that are tangential, instead of making the main thing the main thing. And yes, you know, my work is in education policy. Creed does a lot of education policy work, and everyone feels like they're experts in schools because they went to one, right? But this is particularly acute and expert work, and focusing on reading levels and performance in mathematics actually does have a relationship to how you teach and the backgrounds of the students that you teach. They have a relationship. So this is about power at the end of the day, and we're all going to inevitably suffer as a result if we're too focused on keeping someone down instead of pulling everybody up.
History seems to be inextricably intertwined, Dr. Aldridge, with politics. And some say that with increasing amounts of undeniable evidence that this nation is moving toward authoritarianism, where the president has ultimate authority. It's what we fought against when we fought the American Revolution. It's what the Allies fought against when they were winning out against Hitler and others in World War II. But a lot of young people today believe we would be better off with a strongman form of government where the leader can get things done. You're a history teacher. Does that come from some fundamental ignorance of what authoritarian governments really mean for citizens? And is that because we don't teach historical examples?
A lot of things. Number one, students, you know, or, you know, even good students at Davis in college or elite students do not have great knowledge of the past, of the American past or of the world past on any level, you know? But yet they are not authoritarian kids. So it isn't like somehow if you're not educated, you're automatically turned authoritarian, you know? I wouldn't go that far about it. I think what's pushing this direction is there's been a steady increase in presidential power throughout the 20th century, you know? At the expense of Congress. Part of that also is so legislators can lick their finger, stick it in the wind. If the president's popular, they're all going to say I co-sign on it. If it isn't, I had nothing to do with it. You know? So there is a sense of growing presidential power, and people are frustrated about gridlock and about the feeling that, you know, no national objectives are being accomplished. So that's why this flurry of action by Trump has bumped up his popularity very slightly. I think it's just a lot of people are impressed by the appearance of something being done after Biden. But I think we shouldn't get too maximal. Like this is the beginning of the new millennium and everything swings. Politics goes up and down. By 2028, things may look very differently. You know, Kamala Harris could be president. So let's also not over panic about short-term developments and thinking that they're leading to the end of the republic. The fight goes on. The civil rights movement was a long struggle. It lasted from the end of slavery until the present. So all these struggles are long term. I think don't get too paranoid that, you know, everything is lost because of the last election and a thing or two that Donald Trump does or says.
And Dorothy, the civil rights movement was a fight for social justice. Those who protested during the civil rights movement, those who, like you, braved harassment and taunts and other things to integrate the schools, those who marched in the streets following the death of George Floyd, were all protesting for social justice. And many of the programs enacted to redress those grievances over the years were aimed at balancing the scales somewhat. Republicans and others now on the right refer to that as wokeism. We're living through different times. We're using different words. But is this the same fight that you were fighting when you walk through the doors at Harding?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I say that our goal was to change the education system in America when that happened. Of course, for me, in 1957, it was a lot different than it was in 1965 when Charlotte moved forward. But that's a fight, James, that and Mike and Dr. Aldrich, is that, you know, we have to continue to have. We're going to have it. So, yes, I continue, as others, continue to have that fight. But sometimes I get sort of disillusioned that 68 years, I'm fighting the same fight that I fought 68 years ago. But the other part of it is, we as African Americans in this country have been fighting this fight over 400 years.
Dorothy, you were at the beginnings of the movements of the movement to integrate Charlotte Mecklenburg schools. And at one point, Charlotte Mecklenburg schools were the poster child for successful integration of the schools. People came here from around the country to see what was the magic sauce, the secret sauce that made us successful. And then it ended when parents filed a lawsuit to end busing for racial integration so that kids could go to, quote, neighborhood schools. We are now watching and have been for several years now the resegregation of our schools. Do you believe that the impact of this is that we're going back to segregated schools where the more affluent, the whiter children are going to charter schools and private schools, etc.? And what will be the impact of that?
Well, from what I see now, this is what it is. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that not enough of us are out here fighting the fight. And they don't understand the importance of children learning together. We live in a world of diversity, and a lot of people say don't use that word. But we are. So what happens to these children when they get out of school and they go in the workplace, and the workplace does not look like the classrooms that they came out?
But some would say, because Charlotte has this problem with social capital, that we don't. There was this big study several years ago that indicated that although we may be integrated in the workplace, when the 5 o'clock bell rings, and particularly on Sunday mornings, we go to our corners. We're not integrated in real life. And that is after 50 years of integration of the public schools. So has it worked?
No. And that's hard, Mike, for me to ask. I can say in some cases it has, but in a lot of cases it has not. And I'm going to say again, it has not, We don't have the fight that we had back in the 60s when people were trying to make a difference for all children in our public school. And some people, they just accept it. And when I say accept it, and I'm talking about especially those children, families, and we don't have the leadership. I'll put it this way. We don't have the leadership we had back in 1957 in the 60s to move forward. That's part of the problem. But you talked about Reginald Hawkins and some of the others across the country. They did it for a reason, because they felt that that was, as my dad used to say, it's morally right that you have the right to have the same education, but it's morally right. But nowadays, people don't have those conversations. They just accept what has happened to our children in the school.
James, one of the things that your organization, Creed, envisions is a day when race will no longer be the primary predictor of educational outcomes. And I assume that means that today it is. Why, and how do we reverse course on that? And I only have maybe a minute left.
Yeah, it's very briefly. It's because we never achieved integration, Mike. We desegregated. Integration is a status of harmony. And although we did attempts to put different bodies in different buildings, we never achieved the sort of parity that we once envisioned, and that is the true spirit of Brown. The way we do that is by continuing to be courageous, continuing to fight, continuing to make ourselves uncomfortable, to make the decisions that don't benefit one powerful group over another or other groups. And that work remains to be done. It's our hope that we work up and muster up the courage to ensure the victories of the past and secure new victories in the future. So we got to show up, ready to fight and not be discouraged.
And of course, Donald Trump has ended DEI at all levels of the federal government, and some corporate executives are doing the same. I have 15 seconds, Dr. Aldridge. What do we make of this?
It's a pushback against, it's about power, and it's pushback against, I think, excesses of DEI that is now overwhelming, killing everything else. We should push
and
back.
And with that, I have to stop. I have to stop. Dr. Dan Aldridge from Davidson College, Dr. James Ford from Creed NC, and Dorothy Count Scoggins. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.